You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, Wisconsin Supreme Court Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson is filing a lawsuit to keep her post after voters approved a constitutional amendment that would likely remove her from the position. We'll hear what's at stake.
First, South Carolina police officer Michael Slager was charged with the murder of black motorist Walter Scott on Tuesday after video footage emerged of the officer shooting Scott repeatedly in the back as he fled.
Slager, who is white, pulled over Scott, who is black, while Scott was driving with a broken taillight. According to police reports, Scott fled the traffic stop and was chased down and tasered by the officer, which did not stop him from fleeing.
The officer reported that Scott got a hold of his taser, but video evidence suggests that Scott didn't actually have a taser when he was shot in the back. Scott's family has said he was fleeing to avoid being jailed for back child support payments.
The case has attracted national attention. It comes at a time of heavy media focus on shootings of black men by white police officers around the country. There's also video footage of the shooting, and the police officer in this case has been charged.
Cami Chavis-Simmons joins us now. She's a professor of law and the director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University. She's also a former federal prosecutor. Cami, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, this shooting happened in North Charleston, a largely African-American city with a majority white police force. How is the response from the police department so far compared with similar cases around the country?
Interesting is that if I could have a textbook of how you would handle a situation like this, I would choose the North Charleston response. In comparison to what we've seen in Ferguson and perhaps even Staten Island and other communities, the officer was swiftly brought to justice. Now, a lot of people are questioning whether or not that would have been so swift if we didn't have that video footage. And, of course, you know, we may never know the answer to that. But just in terms of the mayor and the police department, I think stepping back, being fair, we have to again let this play out in the justice system. But at the very same time, after seeing that video and just taking very quick action to fire the officer and to bring the charges, I think was the right thing to do.
And the police officer in this case, as you said, has been charged with murder, and very quickly. There hasn't been the long wait to find out if there will be charges. Is the difference the video, or is the difference perhaps momentum of awareness of some of these issues we're seeing?
Well, when we're thinking as a prosecutor, when you're considering charges and you want to bring charges, you have ethical guidelines that you have to follow. You still have to have probable cause that this person committed this crime and that you're likely to be successful at trial. So there's some ethical considerations here. But what the swiftness of it does suggest to me is that. Not only do we have this video evidence, we recently have heard from the witness in this case who did capture this incident on video, and he has said that the officer didn't give a warning. He said that the suspect did not struggle with the officer with the taser, did not have a taser when the officer shot him. And so those, when we're thinking about whether or not police uses of force are justified, all of that is relevant. So we do have the image on video, which I think is a helpful piece of evidence. But it's not always going to be conclusive, and I think we need to be careful about thinking that this is an open or shut case.
Commentators, some of them out there anyway, have suggested that perhaps if this video of the shooting didn't exist, the officer could very well not have been charged. What do you make of that suggestion?
Well, I think that, and that has been a popular sentiment, and where that sentiment comes from, is this very real authority and credibility that we give to officers in our justice system. The word of an officer in the court of law carries a great deal of weight for jurors. I think, unfortunately, what we're seeing with a lot of these incidents as they come to light is that credibility is going to be chipped away. But there's always been, among police experts, lawyers, judges, and other police officers know that Police officers don't tell the truth 100% of the time. They are like other human beings and are prone to lying. It's disconcerting when we have members who hold our public trust like that engage in that behavior, but it does happen. And there are high-profile incidents that we can point to, the Los Angeles Rampart scandal, where officers falsified evidence and lots of convictions had to be overturned because of that. So it does happen, and this case is just a reminder of that.
Obviously, as you said, a lot of factors go into any case like this that have to be considered, lots of different gatherings of evidence here. In terms specifically of the video and other evidence in this case, how does that compare, say, with the case of Eric Garner, where there was also a video recording and that officer was not charged? How is this different?
Well, and this is when I said earlier, you know, we have to be very careful to understand that this is not necessarily an open and shut case. I viewed the video in the Eric Garner case and those circumstances, and I was very surprised by the grand jury's decision not to return an indictment there. And I would also be surprised if the officer in this case were exonerated. But what we have to remember is that the legal standards give officers a wide latitude. Tennessee versus Garner says that you cannot use deadly force to apprehend a suspect if that suspect's not posing a danger to the officer or danger to the general public. But and Graham versus Connor, another case that gives us all types of factors to help us figure out, well, what is reasonable? And the problem is that jurors are willing, you know, if that officer says, I feared for my life, or I thought that he had a weapon and he was running away, that kind of thing, that's where juries can make these decisions, and we see these non-indictments or not guilty verdicts.
We're talking right now about the police-involved shooting death of Walter Scott in South Carolina with Cammie Chavis-Simmons of Wake Forest University. And you're getting at this a little, Cammie. You've said this is not an open and closed case, that we have to be careful as we look at this to realize that. What sorts of things do you think could come to bear on this case that might hypothetically strengthen the officer's defense?
Yes, well, right, and right now it does seem that, you know, the prosecution would have the upper hand. From what we know publicly, we have that video, we have and we have the testimony of the witness, and I think all of that evidence seems very strong. Of course, the officer, as a criminal defendant in this case, would not have to testify, but in these types of cases, you would see the defense offering testimony that the officer feared for his life or had seen a weapon or something like that. But it's very difficult here, very difficult, where we have Walter Scott running away. And again, this was not, he was not stopped for being suspected for some violent crime. It was a traffic infraction. And I think it's very important to remember that. So when we think about whether or not it's reasonable to use deadly force in this situation, I say no. Of course, there we never know what other evidence could come to light. So far, there hasn't been anything.
Now, you've seen this video. Looking at it from a legal perspective, what are some of the things that you would key in on that any prosecutor is going to be looking for in that same video?
So, as a prosecutor looking to prosecute the officer and substantiate the murder charge, the fact that, as I said, the subject was running, he was stopped not for a violent offense, but for a traffic offense. So we don't, you know, an officer always has to be on guard, you know, that a subject may pose a danger to him. People are not happy when they're stopped for various reasons. But I think the nature of that stop, I think the fact that that the subject did not have the taser, as the officer indicated, and I would certainly, as a prosecutor, have the jury look at that tape and then look at that officer's statement. They are completely inconsistent, and so showing me that the officer is not credible, so that would be something that I would focus on as well.
We're speaking right now with Cammie Chavis-Simmons about the shooting death of Walter Scott as he fled police officer Michael Slager in North Charleston, South Carolina. That officer was charged with murder on Tuesday after video footage was made public.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments and your questions. Have you watched this video? What did you think? Is this an argument for greater use of police body cameras? Do you think the officer may not have been charged if that video didn't happen to get caught? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue that conversation after a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Cammie Chavis-Simmons about the shooting death of a black motorist as he fled a white police officer in South Carolina. That officer was charged with murder on Tuesday after video footage was made public.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this case? Have you seen the video? What is your reaction? What do you think needs to change? Do you agree with the decision to charge the officer in this incident? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And, Cammie, there were some reports that came out that this officer, Michael Slager's lawyer, dropped him once this video emerged. What is the precedent for a defense lawyer doing that in a case maybe similar to this?
Well, I'm not sure about other cases similar to this, but certainly when we're thinking about legal ethics, all lawyers are governed by rules of professional responsibility in their jurisdiction, and those rules typically will state that as a criminal defendant, you are entitled to defense. But at the same time, there's nothing that mandates a lawyer has to represent a particular client. Since he had only been, I guess, engaged for a couple of days, it would have just been a minimal inconvenience to the officer here, and he would have time to procure other counsel. I do worry about, and I don't know that the lawyer in this case has said anything, but when your clients come to you, you have to, and they tell you things. There are strict rules about confidentiality, and then also not doing anything to that you learned in representing the client, not doing anything to embarrass that client. So I would be very concerned if that lawyer began to talk about his reasons, I think, for dropping his client. I think we can leave that up to speculation, but I think you don't say anything about why you dropped your client.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Carl with us in Hartford. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to respond to a couple of things that were posed in this dialogue. The first one being, would the officer have been charged if the video hadn't surfaced? I think it's clear that the officer would not have been charged, which is not, beyond reason. It wasn't any contradictory evidence that wouldn't have supported his stance, which brings into mind that, body cameras, these type of devices that validate occurrences on the road with officers, I think, need to be instituted.
All right. Well, thank you for that that comment, Carl. Appreciate that. And so, Carl, emphasizing the importance of this video and also, this ongoing awareness we have about body cams and the move for people to instate them. What do you think about that case?
Yes, I think that I am personally an advocate for body cameras because in terms of police accountability, there's just no greater transparency. We always, even in cases where the suspect doesn't die, there can be situations, different accounts. So body cameras will give that objective account. There are lots of studies that show, there's some limited number of studies that show that body cameras can reduce the number of complaints that officers generate, and they can also reduce the uses of force that officers use. There's three studies I'm thinking about, one from Rialto, California, one from Mesa, Arizona, and then one recently, the results of which were released just a couple of weeks ago from San Diego, California. In San Diego, complaints against officers fell by 40%, and personal body force is what we call it, fell by 46.5%. The use of pepper spray fell by 30.5%. So there's some correlation there between the officers wearing the cameras and those complaints. A couple of different reasons for that, or different theories behind why that might be. Officers who are wearing these cameras are going to be on better behavior if their actions are being captured, but it also goes for citizens as well. Citizens, both officers, I think, and citizens are less likely to escalate these situations if they know that their actions are being filmed. But as helpful as I think that body cameras can be, they are a relatively new technology just in terms of being used in more law enforcement agencies, and there are lots of different policy issues that we have to think through when we're thinking about these cameras.
Well, let's get into some of those policy issues and legal aspects. Are there other things that need to be contended with before there's both widespread use of body cameras and also buy-in from police forces in the use of them?
Yes. What's interesting is that I think that police executives, some of the folks who champion the use of these cameras the most, tend to be police chiefs. You will see just in the literature that police chiefs are very favorable towards the use of body cameras, because they can use them as an evaluation tool, a supervisory tool, and a training tool. I think that the use of these cameras is not as widespread as most folks would think. The majority of law enforcement agencies in the United States do not yet have body cameras, and even those that do, not all of their officers are equipped with them. But when we think about some of the policy issues, these cameras should not be given to police officers without some very clear guidance as to how they're going to use them. At what point do you turn on your camera? It's not really feasible to have your camera, your personal body camera, running all the time. With the difference with dash cams is that typically those can be activated by some technological, as soon as I begin pursuing a suspect and I turn my lights on, then the camera would come on. With body cameras, there's a lot more human intervention that has to happen. So with that, you have more discretion. So we need to make sure that officers have clear guidelines as to when these cameras are turned on. There are some privacy issues. Do we want to videotape all types of suspects, sexual assault victims, juveniles? There are other citizens whose actions may be captured by the tape. Everybody has privacy rights. So there are a lot of those policy issues that states are dealing with. And also, too, the information, what do we do with this footage? How long is it stored? Who gets to review it? So lots of different issues that have to be dealt with.
Let's take another call now. Sherry is joining us from Whitewater. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. The thing that bothered me the most about the video, aside from the fact that the police officer was murdering a man, was that the second officer on the scene doesn't even question it when the first officer comes and drops the taser by this man's body. Neither of them, have tried to revive him or give him any assistance, and they seem so comfortable doing this that it was just chilling to me. How used to doing this are they? How common is this? You know what I'm saying?
Sherry, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. Sherry, you're talking about something that's been a topic of a lot of conversation about why attempts weren't made to revive Walter Scott.
Yes, I saw that on the video, and I was very disturbed by the officer's reaction. Now, and his argument might be, well, I'm a professional. If I thought I had done something wrong, there are certain protocols, but he just if I had just shot and injured someone, and maybe he didn't know he was dead, if I had just shot, you know, my weapon 8 times, I would be frantic that this has happened. So the coolness of it, I think, their indifference really seemed to be indifference is concerning. The other officer on the scene, that raises an issue for me because one thing we know about police culture is the sense of group loyalty. The things that keep police officers safe from day to day, you know, knowing that another officer is going to have their back and protect them, the same thing that sometimes impedes these investigations. So, and we don't know, I don't know anything about that second officer on the scene, exactly what he saw or when he saw it, but it would be very interesting to know what, if he filled out an incident report, which he should have, what does that report say? Does it corroborate what the other officer said that we now know to not be true? And then that, to me, indicates just a larger problem, perhaps a larger problem within the police department and the culture of the police department.
And Cammie, you're calling for a federal database to really get answers on trends of excessive police force, locations where it might be a particular issue. What would a database tell us that we don't have now?
Well, a national database would tell us a lot. We don't. There are some. I think we refer to them as crowdsourcing, websites that have gathered, you know, people who are gathering this data. There's not a comprehensive national database at this moment. The president has signed a law that will create that national database, but it could tell us a lot. It could tell us about under what circumstances are officers discharging their service weapons? Against whom are they using the most force? Is it males versus females? Is it racial minorities versus whites? It could also be a valuable training tool, and we could look at departments who departments that have very low uses of force, and we could say, well, what is it? You know, what is it about this department that's different than, you know, this other department and this other part of the state that has all these problems? And we can compare and contrast those best practices. But I think it would be a very valuable training tool and policy development tool. It's very difficult to reform or to address a problem if you don't know the underlying causes.
Cammie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Cammie Chavis-Simmons about the police-involved shooting death of Walter Scott in South Carolina. The officer was charged with murder on Tuesday after the release of video footage. You can continue the conversation on this issue over at the Central Time Facebook page.